Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 90th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is building the innovation muscle of your company. I'm joined by Ben Bensau. He is the author of Built to Innovate, Essential Practices to Wire Innovation into Your Company's DNA. The publisher is McGraw-Hill. Ben is a professor and former dean of executive education at INSEAD. He's also been a visiting professor at the Harvard Business School, a research fellow at the Wharton School of Management, and a visiting scholar at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. Let's dive right in. Can you give a brief overview of your book, if you don't mind?
Okay, so I would say that the book is about continuous innovation and how to embed continuous innovation within your organization. It starts from the fact that many people think you need a genius leader or to be a startup to innovate, and that's not true. I found established, even century-old companies able to innovate. And the book is really about how these organizations were able to innovate using continuous and systematic innovation, innovation of all kinds and driven by everyone in the organization.
Okay. And I think that's great. The deeper I got into the book and the more you had examples, including, you're right, some older companies, I found that fascinating. I want to go to one of those models. I guess it's maybe, if I'm not mistaken, the Bayer model, but I think you kind of seem like you were applying it potentially more generally as a good template, or at least one worth exploring, because you tend to be, you know, open to many possibilities, which fits being a creative type and an innovator yourself. And I'm speaking specifically to the fact that it's kind of like a dual structure. There is the what you call the execution engine, and then the innovation engine. And the first one, the execution engine, tends to have a hierarchical organizational structure very often. The innovation engine, a freer and flatter kind of model. And my question basically is, and I'll probably have a follow-on question or two, but surely there must be instances where there's some friction between those two models simultaneously existing within a company.
Yes, I think that as you say, the execution engine is something that every organization needs, and what I'm kind of suggesting is that innovation has always been thought to be relegated to either the leaders or like we were talking earlier about the R&D department, but in fact anybody can innovate, so. Execution engine is very much about control, and it's no surprise that when executing, organizations have layers of hierarchy, and they have control systems, very sophisticated systems. They have silos which are focused on the problems that the organization is trying to solve. So you have a design department, you have a marketing department trying to sell, you have a production department, but the innovation engine is less about control, is more about delegation, about collaboration, about cross disciplinary teams. So, for instance, I can give you an example where there's a company that I talk about. It's called Kordsa. It's a Turkish supplier of quite of a commodity product. I mean, they make fabric that is used to reinforce tires for the automobile industry. And what they do is that they send cross-functional teams to their customers' plants. So in the team, you might have people from design, production, marketing, legal, and they go to the customers' plants and they stay there for a few days. They literally camp at the customers' plants, and they just kind of walk around, observe, talk to people. And so you see, instead of having a siloed, vertical siloed organization, this is a horizontal cross-disciplinary team that is going focused on the customer, not on the problems, but on the customer. And they were telling me that at one plant one day, they observed that the customer team was having difficulties to safely manipulate rolls of fabric that had been loaded on a truck. And again, the team had, I mean, the customer had never talked to them about that, and the team didn't even know about that. But then they had the impression they were peeking into a problem that nobody knew about. So when they came back, they studied it, and they developed a little methodology, and they trained the customer into offloading those roles. And they changed it to 90 minutes for three people to actually being able to do it in 12 minutes with wow. one worker. So this is again, there's no friction there, because you just have the execution engine and the innovation engine are working in parallel, but they have very different structures and processes and even cultures.
Okay. And is there instances where someone is actually in both those engines, so to speak, simultaneously?
Not simultaneously at any moment. The whole okay. point that I make in Build to Innovate is that instead of splitting the company in the innovators, the R&D people, and the people who are professionals of innovation, and the others are there just to execute what they're told, I'm just arguing that anybody has innovating capabilities to start with. Plus, if we give them permission, if we give them training, they can develop innovating capabilities. So the argument is to have anybody in the company be able to operate in both engines, not necessarily at the same moment at a precise time, but anybody, even at the front line, even a receptionist, can find times to participate in some innovating activity.
Okay. Well, speaking
to give you an example, Dan. A simple thing. For instance, a salesperson typically spends a lot of time, trying to sell the project, the product to the customer. So the good salespeople, they do this very intuitively and very naturally. At some point, they switch their mind from sell mode to listen mode. And they try to hear what the customer is not saying, or they try to understand what the problem that the customer is struggling with. So that's what I'm talking about. It's a mindset. It's about switching your mindset from a supply side view to a customer side view. And anybody can do that. Even a receptionist can do that.
Oh no! I don't get me wrong. I love the concept, and I'm fully on board with the notion that it should be much broader. Just having been in corporate life myself, I'm trying to understand some of the difficulties that can arise at times. So let's move to. I'm still kind of staying on this topic, but let me shift a little bit. So, for instance, you mentioned people might have time allocated or allowed or enabled to, quote unquote, dabble, to be creative. I'm quite familiar with this. My father was in charge of 3M printed Post-it notes, production, all sales, right, and marketing. Yes. Uh-huh. And 3M, of course, has its famous 15% rule, which mandates you have plenty of time to be creative. So I understand that certainly both from my father's own experiences and so forth. But I can imagine, or have to imagine, based on my experience in corporate life, there are not always managers who are as open to this notion of the dual engines and of the importance of creativity, and they're looking for accountability from someone. So I'll start with one really just tactical question, which is, in given that time to quote-unquote dabble or be creative, are there controls in effect? Are there ways in which accountability is asked for, or is it just quite free-form? And what do you see works best, and where are the potential pitfalls to overcome?
Well, I mean, your question is very good. It actually points to something that really surprised me doing the research for the book for Built to Innovate. I did not expect how that middle managers would be so important to innovation.
Yeah,
that goes to the core of your question, because they are the ones. I mean, of course, the CEO puts innovation at the core of strategy and gives the permission to people to innovate. But the ones who effectively create the dabble time, the people who coordinate it, create the space and the time for it, are the middle managers. So the middle managers are actually pivotal to innovation. And what I found is that you talk to senior people, and they're facing, you know, a tough environment, high in uncertainty, fast pace. So for them, innovation is a no-brainer. They understand it. Similarly, then, frontline people, they're with the customers and the non-customers on a daily basis. So they understand the problems. They understand the dissatisfaction. They understand people kind of screaming for something new. The ones who don't get this direct, immediate pressure of innovation are the middle managers, because in the end, they are the ones who are responsible for the execution engine.
Yes.
So what I found is that I have like a few examples in the book, but let me take, for instance, Bayer. You were talking about Bayer, the pharmacology and life sciences global corporation based in Germany. So with a rich history of scientific achievements, they were able to create an innovating engine, and they were able to leverage the innovating capabilities of the 100,000 people working in the company. So how did they do this? First, they made the whole board responsible for innovation.
Which
the
I
whole
love.
Board.
Yes. Yeah.
Then they selected 80 senior managers covering all country groups and global functions to support the board as innovation ambassadors. You see, and these ambassadors, they spent much of their time with middle managers, explaining, advocating, and sponsoring innovation. So I've seen, for instance, and this is very important, and I'll explain why it is important. They created a formidable support structure for these middle managers. If I remember correctly, between 2016 and 2020, they trained and certified 1,000 innovation coaches locally activated around the world. So you see, middle managers, they don't know about innovation. They're not the one who can help their people. So they need to be explained. They need to be trained first. Then they don't have the time. They have to care about the execution engine. So you need to create this support structure, like a central unit that is going to train and certify people who can coach their teams in innovating. And then you put these people at their disposal so that when their team come up with an idea, an individual innovator or a project team wants to work on something, the middle manager can call upon this central resource to come and help his team or her team.
Sure. And isn't there also what you're called innovation connectors?
Exactly. Exactly. And then what they had is that these middle managers, they had these innovation coaches who were spread around the company. So they came to a point where every kind of unit would have an innovation coach on call. And then when somebody would have an idea, they would have a local innovation coordinator. So because they figured that when you create, you might have heard of these experiments where people create an information system where you can send you ideas. The problem with these systems, these information systems, is that very often people send ideas and never get an answer.
Yeah, they're very passive in terms of...
They're very passive, and people get discouraged after they send three or four ideas and they get no responses. So some of these companies, they like Bayer, they create a local innovator so that when you have an idea, you send it to this to the platform, and a local innovator is going to respond to your idea or request or question within 15 days. And that gets the engine humming. That gets the engine jump started, because otherwise what I see is that people want to innovate. I mean, the frontline people are full of ideas.
Yes.
But the problem is that first we can talk about that maybe later. They're sometimes afraid, but what do they do with their ideas? Where do they send them? So you need to have a mechanism that winnows and channels and selects these ideas all the way up to implementation, and then they move to the execution engine.
Yeah, and instead of being stymied, they need some support and the chance to pull in resources. So staying with Bayer and staying with this the role of the middle managers, because I'm totally in support of where you're coming from with the book. I'm just kind of probing on what I see as the given human nature and given how things get structured sometimes, how people respond, and therefore how to push through those difficulties to make this, realize its full potential. So sticking with the middle managers, there was a comment from, I believe it was a Dr. Till at Bayer, who said they didn't incentivize individual results. And I guess I took that to mean they didn't do that for managers, but I may be wrong in how I read it. So part of it, I'm seeking clarification, but then I'm wondering, okay, some middle managers are going to be on board with innovation. They will actually get it for whatever the reasons. Some will be, as you said, undecided. And some, frankly, as you mentioned, will be resistant. So especially if they're resistant, is educating them on the importance of innovation going to be enough? Doesn't it need incentives potentially? I'm wondering how Dr. Till at Bayer got to this point of deciding that incentives, at least for managers, didn't make sense or didn't work.
Well, I think the point he was trying to make is that the incentives, you don't want to put incentives on the innovators, the people who have to come up with the idea. Because, and of course, as soon as you do that, you freeze. I mean, people get, stressed and all that. So the incentives.
So it is for the innovators in general not to do that. Okay.
So, but still, the incentives are good for the middle managers. I'll give you another example, which is not Bayer, but it's Allianz, the financial giant, the insurance giant. For instance, as Allianz UK, they created an incentive system where they would, simply publish the innovation league of the business units in the UK. So every once in a while they would publish the top league of business units in terms of their contribution to innovation. So here the incentive is put on the middle manager in terms of the contribution of his or her team to innovation. And of course you can imagine that nobody wants to be on the bottom of that league table. So here the idea is always to try to encourage everyone at the front line to innovate, and one in the incentives for the front line, of course, is once you give them you may remember there's another quote in the book of that left a mark on me, is a former board member of Allianz who said, for people to innovate, they need to feel that they are able, capable, and motivated. So able means that they have the permission to innovate, that they are allowed to innovate. Capable is that means that they are given the training, they're given the support, they're given the resources to do it. And motivated, it means that they you stimulate the desire in them to innovate. And for this, it's really a question of creating challenge and like people create hackathons and all sorts of challenges where people can come and innovate together. You want to recognize and celebrate their contribution to innovation. So, like Dr. Trill says, maybe having a presentation in front of the board is much more motivating for frontline people than a small reward, financial reward, even if they do get maybe a small reward. But it's more of an emotional reward that people that gets people moving into innovation. Because the bottom line is that people, they do execution 95% of their time. So if you give them space where they are given permission, it's protected, it's a safe space where it's politically protected, where they can innovate, it's fun for them. People enjoy that. And you may notice also in Built to Innovate, there are a few examples where people lost top talent because they were stopping innovation from frontline people.
Yeah, no, I think everyone wants a chance for some variety, for one thing, and the creative fulfillment. I could see that, if the managers are getting nice financial bonuses and the people coming up with the actual ideas, on the other hand, do get the recognition. I love the idea of presenting to the board, for instance, but I could imagine that just potentially that's going to rub some people wrong if they think they're coming up with the new revenue streams and the managers are the ones seeing the money from having allowed it to happen. Is that at all a fair critique, or how do you see that situation?
Oh, I think that the incentives are usually team-based, of course. Everybody gets...
Okay.
But
even for the manager, so if they get incentivized financially, it's to the people that were on the teams, and that's money spread not just to the manager but to the teams? I just want to make sure I understand how this flows.
Yes, how to understand the logic of it, yes.
Okay, because we both know that a lot of people use money as a yardstick to keep track of things, but better or for worse. Yes.
Again, we were talking about Bayer. I can give you another example of how they got everybody on board, if you will. They created, so now I talked to you about the role of the senior leaders, and then the middle managers. And then to really motivate the front line, they created a digital platform. They called it WeSolve. Yep. So WeSolve is a digital platform where any employee can post a problem they're struggling with and invite input and ideas from anyone else across the organization. So I visited once the website, and they say that at any given time you have about 200 challenges that you can find them on the platform, and they have 40,000 Bayer employees from around the world who have participated in this WeSolve platform. Mind you,
I think that's great. My favorite comment from the book comes from the person at Kortsa, the Turkish company you mentioned earlier, who made a reference to the democratization of innovation, which I absolutely categorically love. That's my favorite comment probably from the book.
How we should have called the podcast, Democratize Innovation. You see, I knew it was somewhere. Yeah.
Well,
I'll remember it for next time.
Okay, fair enough. I want to go to another place, and I'm not picking on the book at all, because I love where it's coming from. But I am trying to press a bit on, again, what I see as the practical issues at times. So here's one I can speak to from personal experience, having I've been traditionally a market researcher working with actually more than half the world's top 100 companies, B2C companies. So I've encountered not less than quite a few creatives, as we'll call them. And I actually have a master's in creative writing and poetry, back in the day. So I'm very open to the creative process. What I've sometimes seen is the issue for some of them, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, is I guess I'm not sure what label to put on it. One I might say is a bit solipsistic. Another one might be a bit elitist. And I'm saying that because I see instances where some designers, including offer or product designers, some ad agency people, they can be kind of in the stage of creating love children, mm-hmm, love child.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yes. I'm trying to imagine some of the people, given their egos at times, actually learning from and valuing the input of someone who's maybe in a call center, in the customer service department, works in a store that the company has as an ally. I'm trying to see how you get those people to really respect and make good use of the, I think, tremendously valuable insights that frontline people can offer.
This is very important. Very important question. Actually, when you were describing the problem, I could not help remember the example. I think it's mentioned in the book, but it's not described as brutally as you may think it is. But this is
at times
Ecosem. Ecosem, you remember the French cement company?
Yes, I do.
Well, I mean, a great story of, I mean, this is actually a startup, but great story. And this is within the French environment. And there's this CEO who is trying to create this space. I think one important thing for the innovation engine and that the middle management is to create is to create a space where they can reduce the distance, the gap between the innovators, the people who are going to have the ideas, and the customers. So, and also reduce the distance between the people who are generating the ideas within the company and the people who are going to sell the ideas. So what this gentleman, the CEO, Donald Ryan, had done, he had created these teams where he would bring cross-disciplinary teams together to work. And I mean, you add a little bit of the French educational system structure here, and you had this very arrogant engineers from the top universities in France who were working with lab technicians, and they were working on innovation, and they were basically dominating the conversation. They wouldn't even let people speak up. So the CEO decided to actually deal with this as a leadership, as a management problem, not an innovation problem. So he brought in a coach, a leadership coach, who took the team together and worked with them, and they kind of all understood that There's no way you can know ex ante where is the good comment going to come from, where is the good idea going to come from. And it had to go through a process where, in particular, this top engineers and researchers would realize that they were missing some of the comments from the customers, and it was very humbling for them. So, at some point, I would say you may need to bring in. Maybe this is something that the HR people can help with. But in chapter 10, I explain the methodology that I've been testing over the last 15 years, and there's a moment, I think it's in step two, where you have to bring the team together and create a culture for the team, right? So, and this is where you have to discuss what are the goals. So people have to come together, understand the shared goals, what are the shared values, what are the key processes? How are we going to make decisions? How are we going to resolve conflict? What are the different roles, and make sure that people rotate roles? This is an important thing.
Yeah.
It's not always the same people who have the same role. I mean, because now you see, innovating teams, they're not execution teams where you have specialists and people who know more than others. Here, these are cross-functional teams. These are teams that they don't work together, and there's no boss there. right? There's no boss. This is a team, and the only boss actually is a customer, right? Yes. So people have to realize that they have to, and they have to. I mean, there's like these five steps they have to go through even before they start the project. Once they have agreed on, you know, the goals, the values, the processes, the roles, and the individual commitment, then they can start to work. But they, and actually I get people to write this on a template and read it systematically before every meeting.
Yeah, well, I like that a lot, not only from my corporate experiences, but having played a lot of what you would call football and us in the States, soccer as well as basketball. Rotating roles would be nice to create greater empathy, because I play with some forwards or wingers or strikers who didn't want to play any defense on behalf of the team. They just saw themselves in a very specialized role, and there was a certain, I guess I'd have to call it being a midfielder, a certain arrogance built in at times.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Could be frustrating and detrimental, more importantly, to the cohesion of the team and its effectiveness.
But it doesn't take much. It takes only a few visits. I mean, you talked about a key word here for me in innovating is the word empathy. When these teams and for instance, in some cases, I send people by pairs to visit, you know, a branch of a bank or a department store. I send people in teams of two to, and then when they start to observe the customer, I mean, this is where you realize that it's not always those who you think are the smartest who notice the most important thing. And I think this is something that people learn by being faced with the situation, and when they're confronted with it. I mean, this is where it brings humility and respect for the other members of the team.
I couldn't agree more. We're kind of have to wrap up here in a moment, but to that point, there's a wonderful statement from Charles Darwin about survival of the quote-unquote fittest, although he never exactly said that. But his point was it wasn't necessarily the strongest, the smartest, the fastest. It was the most adaptive who actually did the best. So I want to thank you, Ben, so much. This has been episode number 90. It's called Building the Innovation Muscle of Your Company. My guest, Ben Bissau, he is the author of Built to Innovate, Essential Practices to Wire Innovation into Your Company's DNA. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com, or on the New Books Network, type in Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, and you'll see the previous 89 guests. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In this case, I took one from a gentleman named Alan Kay, who said, "The best way to predict the future is to invent it." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.